Today, I want to tell you a very remarkable escape from the Japanese that I had during the war, and how wonderfully God delivered us in answer to prayer. Before the war, I and my younger brother were doing pioneer missionary work in Burma. When the war in Europe broke out, we were wanting to volunteer, but we were told that we'd do far better to stay out there and carry on with the work we were doing. However, after Pearl Harbor and the Japanese invaded Burma, the whole situation was quite different. They had practically no troops out in Burma at all, or India. All our best troops were in Europe or in North Africa. They had very few chaplains and very few doctors. And so I volunteered as a chaplain to the forces and was sent right to the front line near Tangu within 24 hours of enlisting, without ever having signed my name on the dotted line or having had any course of training or being told what I should do. After about a month of warfare, when I joined up, everything seemed to have been going wrong. Disaster dogged us on every side. As I've said, we had practically no troops. We weren't ready for the Japanese. We didn't expect their attack. And the result was there was one disaster after another. There was the famous Battle of Satang, where we lost two-thirds of a division who were left on the wrong side of the river when the Japanese did a pincer movement and got to the bridge before us. And so we lost all our tanks, all our guns, and most of the men had to throw away their rifles and try and swim a river of a quarter mile wide or be captured by the Japanese. Then Rangoon was captured. And many people don't realize, but Rangoon in those days was the only way of getting into Burma. There were high mountains both on the east and the west and on the north. And of course, there was so little air. And at any rate, we lost all our air force, which was bombed on the aerodrome at Magwe in the first month of the war, and after that we never saw another Allied airplane. Every time we saw a plane coming over, we knew it was the enemy planes. And as a result, well, the whole campaign of 1942 was a tragedy. We were retreating back, 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 knowing that we could never win a battle, that we hadn't the forces, we hadn't the armament, we hadn't anything. And we all, our morale went down terribly, and we all tended to feel that in the jungle the Japanese were tremendous he-men, that we could never tackle them like they are. And of course we had very heavy casualties. In fact, by the time they got back to India, there was only a very small proportion of those that had started out in the campaign. I would like to tell you many stories of that campaign, but I will just restrict myself to one to give you an idea. I was living on divisional headquarters and driving out to various battalions and trying to hold services and tend the sick and to go to the hospitals. I never found met another chaplain in the whole campaign. We just moved backwards to a wood near Magwe. At that time, of course, we were not ever living in houses. In fact, my whole time of 5 years in the 3 years in the army, I never slept in a house at all, and very seldom in a tent, generally just under the trees. And trees had got the advantages that it prevented the enemy seeing where we were. And we had divisional headquarters there, probably a few hundred men. Every morning the Japanese used to send over two or three aeroplanes in as recce planes to try and discover where we were. And we were told, as we had no anti-aircraft guns, we'd no aeroplanes to keep them off, that we must get into slit trenches and keep as quiet as possible and hope they hadn't seen us. However, this particular morning, two planes came down ever so low over the tops of the trees, and it so annoyed a few of the soldiers that one of them started firing at the planes with his machine gun. This gave the whole position away. The plane immediately flew off, and I remember saying to one of my friends, "Now we've had it." And we had. About 3/4 hour later, 9 Jap bombers came in to bomb us, knowing we were all in that wood. It was only a small wood, perhaps 1/4 mile by 1/2 mile, and all of us were inside it. And they dropped all their bombs, 30 or more bombs, into that one wood. I was, at the time, sitting at a small little table, making some notes for services, and I had on the table beside me a small little briefcase. The Japanese, very cunningly, didn't come flying in high. They used to hop hedges, coming very low, so that we didn't even know they were coming until they were on top of us. So we learned to move quickly when the warning went out. And as I was sitting there, suddenly my batman shouted to me, "Take care, Padre! Japanese bombers!" So I didn't wait to look. I jumped up and flung myself into the nearest slit trench and lay down at the bottom together with a number of other people. I'd barely got in when the first bomb came down, getting louder and louder and louder and louder, and then crash! It was very close to us, and a whole lot, half the trench, seemed to fall in on top of us. I called through to the men behind, "Are you all right?" They said, "Yes, sir, we're all right." But I said, "Take care, there's another one coming." It got louder and louder, bang, and a tree fell down over our trench. The amazing part was that though those bombs dropped so close to us, none of us that were in the slit trenches were injured. There were people, a number were killed and wounded, but they were people who hadn't already got into trenches. But when it was all over and I went back, I saw how wonderfully we'd been delivered. Just to give you an idea, my table, we'll assume, was here. I had run over about 20 yards to the left and jumped into a trench. I think those bombs must have dropped about 30 yards still further, the other side of me. The shrapnel had gone over the top of our trench, it had hit the table and smashed it, and torn my little briefcase to bits. And I realized if I'd been there a second or two longer, that would have been the end of me. Now, this kind of thing was happening continually through the whole campaign. And as I say, we had no power to resist the enemy, and we'd no aeroplanes to hold them back. And so we were getting very discouraged. We were steadily retreating right up through Burma. And then finally, the general came to us at divisional headquarters and said that we couldn't get on with any business retreating so rapidly. We were going to retreat about 60 miles back by motor car to a headquarters where it would give us a few days' breathing space where we could collect and get headquarters working once more. We were all delighted. We felt now we're out of it for just a few days. And we drove back, crossing the Irrawaddy and passing near Mandalay and then turning west and going over to near the Chindrin, nearly to a place called Munua. That we made our headquarters for the moment. The next day I went out to take a short service when a Burmese man ran up very excitedly and speaking in Burmese, which I could understand, as I understood two or three Burmese languages. He said to me, "Take care, take care. Japanese coming up the other side of the river. They're coming to surround you." So I thanked him, and I went off and told the general, who was a very good man indeed, and a very good Christian. He stroked his beard, because, of course, we had no time to shave. And he said, "Well, thank you very much, Padre, but," he said, "if we believed all the rumours we heard, we'd never get on with any work at all." He said, "I don't think there's a single Japanese within 50 miles of us." Unfortunately, he was wrong. The Japanese knew where we were. They were being led up by Burmese spies, and they were coming to surround us that night. Well, in the evening, as we had our evening meal, we discussed. I talked it over and said, "Do you think it's safe to undress?" Perhaps you say, "Why not?" Well, of course not. If the enemy are near, you never undress. 2 years later, I had the privilege of being with General Wingate on the Chindit expedition as an airborne commando, landed behind the Jap lines, and on that occasion for 6 months we never changed our clothes once. In fact, we had no clothes others than what we stood up in, and we'd no pajamas or anything to get into. So you went to bed in soaking wet clothes and muddy clothes, and you just wear the same clothes always. But on this occasion, we thought we were safe. It was a false rumour. And I remember getting undressed and getting into my beautiful striped pyjamas. In the early hours of the morning, we were suddenly wakened up with gunfire and bombs and mortar bombs dropping in the camp. Bang, 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 bang. Bomb, bomb, bomb. And we didn't know from which direction they were coming. The Japanese had almost surrounded us. I jumped up and first ran down the stairs in my pyjamas when somebody said, "Are you going to fight the Japs in your pyjamas?" And so I realized it. So I dashed up again and put on a khaki shirt, khaki short, pulled on my boots. I had no time to do them up, shoved my stockings in my pockets and rushed down and joined in the fray. Little did I know, I was never going to get back to that spot again. If only I'd known I was now going to set out on a long trek for 3 or 4 weeks, walking, because I left behind my water bottle. I left behind a number of other emergencies. I left behind a bag of silver that every officer had as an emergency. But we thought it was only a temporary thing, and we were half asleep at the time. Well, in the mercy of God, we were directed, and some of us were told to get into a dry river bed that was a small ditch, and to follow down there. And we found that this led us out in the one gap where the Japs weren't. And then we lay down behind a road. Now, the roads in Burma, of course, because of the monsoons and the paddy fields, are built up right above the fields. So it made a very natural barrier for us to lie down behind. And I was lying down there on the front line with soldiers going firing, bang, 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 and I couldn't see the enemy at all. But as it got a little bit lighter, a major came over to me and said, "Padre, could you help us?" And I said, "Yes, anything you want." So he said, "Well, there are two men over there on the right, and they've been slightly wounded." And he said, "They seem to have lost their nerve, and they're standing up." And he said, "They'll not only get killed if they stand up, but also they'll give our whole position away." He said, "Could you possibly go over and get hold of them and get them right away behind the lines?" I said, "Where shall I take them, sir?" He said, "Anywhere." And there was a big wood behind, as there are so many in Burma, half a mile or mile in size. He said, "Get them back in there, and then bring them back when we've driven the Japs off." So I got hold of them, took them there, treated them, first field dressing, and waited, and waited, and waited. But we didn't drive off the Japs. They drove us off. And during the next 24 hours, we tried to find where the rest of the soldiers were, but they seemed to have disappeared. We were joined by odd stragglers over the next 24 hours, mainly non-combatants, that means cooks, people working on cipher or radio, and from a lot of different areas, who all came with most terrible pessimistic stories. Nearly all of which was completely untrue, as I learned later. But of course, at the time, one thought perhaps it was true, telling me that nearly all the officers were killed. They thought I was one of the only ones still alive, and that the Japs had overwhelmed us. What was I to do? There were about 20 of us by this time, and there was one sergeant, otherwise all the others were just privates or privates. Most of them wanted us to go straight to India, which was not very far at that time. We were near the banks of the Chindwin River, and you crossed over, and then you'd go over into India. But only a night or two before this attack, the general had spoken to us officers and told us morale was very low, and that he blamed us for it, and that he said, "Everybody's talking about when will we get to India?" Well, he said, "We cannot go to India until the monsoons break, because The Japanese had trained people like Tsuba Bose as a general in Japan already to come over and get the whole of India to rise against the British and have one of their own leaders as general to do it. And so we felt we must hold the Japanese in Burma till the monsoons broke, because there were no roads between Burma and India. And the tiny little mountain tracks, once the monsoon came, would be so impossible to bring motor cars over or guns that they couldn't have attacked us until after the monsoons were over. So he said, we must stay till halfway through May. This was May the 1st, so there was still another fortnight. So, of course, I told the men I could not agree to take them to India. But what was I to do? I didn't know where to go. I hadn't been at any of the staff conferences, and I didn't really know the latest situation. But I had heard that a place called Shwe Bo, which was due north of Mandalay, had been army headquarters. So I thought we'd best go there. It was about 75 miles away. I had no map, but I spoke the language, and I knew somewhat the direction, Burma being a fairly small country, and I had studied it fairly carefully for 8 years while I was a missionary. So instead of going due west or northwest to cross the Chindwin and to go up into India, we went northeast, straight back into Burma. And we travelled along for 3 whole days until we got to Shwe Bo, which was right in the very centre of Burma, 80 miles north of Mandalay. We had a terrible journey. I can't give you the details, but we had no food. We had no drink. We had no water bottles. The temperature was the hottest time of Burma, and probably was around about 112, 115 in the sun, in the shade, and we were in the sun. So you can imagine what it's like. And we were simply dripping, and yet had nothing to drink. I'll just give you one little example. I had to try and get food. I can't go into those details, but on water. We tried to find any stream where there'd be water, because we were afraid of going to villages, lest we'd be captured and handed over by the Burmese, who were many of them very disloyal at that time, to the Japanese. I found a small river, and I thought, ah, now's our water. But alas, being the dry season, it was all dried up. Then I remembered that at the bend of a river, at the elbow of a river, that was where the deepest water was. So we dug down with our hands in the sand and the mud until at last we came to a small amount of water, about a foot or 2 feet deep. And then the whole tour is holding out a handkerchief. We lifted this water and rather muddy, dirty stuff into the handkerchief, wrung it through the handkerchief and drank the contents. That was all the liquid that we were able to get on that journey, that and one or two other similar occasions. Of course, as you know, out east you should never drink unboiled water, but we just had to. There was no other way, otherwise we would have died of thirst. Well, at long last, we arrived at Shwe Bo. Bitter was my disappointment. I thought we were coming to army headquarters, but instead I found the whole town destroyed, burnt almost to the ground. There were certainly no British troops there. What I had not known was that the same night that divisional headquarters was surrounded, Mandalay, the real capital of Burma, was captured. And the Japanese had now, there was nothing between them and the place we'd just gone to, Shwe Bo, 80 miles north, and there was quite a good road running up. The Chinese, who remember were not communists then, they were under Chiang Kai-shek, they were our allies. They had been called in to help cover our retreat. And they had come in to help us get over, and they were to hold that line. But even they had been driven back, and they had had to retreat from Shwe Bo. They had left behind a few men in one truck to do demolition work, blowing up bridges and everything else. We nearly walked into their demolitions and were nearly blown up. At last I found their leader, who spoke just a little English, and he told me what an awful position we were in. He said all the British had gone, There were none in Burma now. We were left behind. And that the Japanese, there was nothing to prevent them arriving any minute. There were no enemy troops between us and the enemy coming up from Mandalay. They were expected any minute. And so he said, "You go quick, quick, quick. Japanese come. You go quick, quick, quick. Japanese come." And as he drew his finger across his throat, I knew quite well it was the usual way the Japanese with their swords cutting our heads off. Well, in that dilemma, I found then, as I've often found since, that many men who've no use for God turn to God in prayer, in panic probably, but often God in their mercy hears them. Of course, naturally, I as a Christian had been praying very much all the time that God would lead me to make right decisions. I had no maps. Everything depended on what decisions I made. And I was praying the Lord would lead me. And during that whole time, for the last day, in a most remarkable way, a verse of Scripture came to my mind, a verse that I had never really noticed before. It was Psalm 50:15, but I couldn't have told you then where it was. It says, "Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me." And it was as if God was saying, "Well, I'm waiting for you." He kept hammering, 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 hammering this one verse, and this only this one verse, in my ears. It was as if he was saying, "Well, are you in trouble? Well, I'm waiting for you to call upon me. When you do, I'll deliver you, and then you can glorify me, as I trust I'm doing today, because we don't take any of the glory for it." Well, it meant that our friends, the Chinese, got into their car, and they drove away. And they said, we said, "What will happen to us?" They said, "Any minute, Japanese will come and..." And that'll be the end of you. So I made my men walk all night to get out of Shui Bo, hoping the enemy might stop when they got as far as Shui Bo for a day or so. And we hurried on up the one and only road in northern Burma at that time. It was a kutcha road, just dirt track, but it was the only way to go. And we hurried on as fast as we could. The one thing we did not want to hear, obviously, was the sound of motor cars, military trucks, coming up the road behind us, because we knew there was nobody between us and the Japanese. About 9 o'clock the next morning, we heard the sound we feared. We could hear trucks coming up the road behind us. So I said, "Quickly, jump into the jungle, get behind the trees. Perhaps the Japs won't see us." But as they drew near, to our amazement, the sergeant said, "I believe, sir, those are not Japanese, those are Chinese." Now perhaps you say, "But surely you knew the difference." No, the extraordinary part was, the Japanese and the Chinese, they looked very alike. They dressed exactly alike in uniform. There was only just a difference of a star. And it had been so bad that earlier on in the campaign, when the Chinese came to help us, we found we'd been fighting for half a day against the Chinese, thinking they were the enemy. So it was very easy to mistake them. And on this occasion, we thought they were Japanese, but to our great joy, they were not. They were Chinese. I believe this was the first answer of prayer. We might call them that as a result of our prayer, God raised up three miracles. I can almost call them that. Three most wonderful, remarkable things. If any one of them had failed, I couldn't be alive today. This was the first one. Each one grows in intensity. Here he produced two completely empty 2,500-weight trucks with only the drivers in them. Where on earth they were coming from? They seemed to be coming straight from the enemy. Where they were going to? Why they were empty? I cannot give you any explanation, and the Chinese drivers couldn't speak English. All I know is they saved our lives. We managed to get into them as they were going north. We felt we'd go north on them. And so we jumped in. And I said, "Go on, go on." And so I told the men how wonderfully God had supplied this need. I knew we couldn't go too far because I knew from my experience of the country that the road petered out at a place called Cumberloo, about 50 or 60 miles further north. And that after that there was no road. But still, it was going to give us some distance. When we got there and we had to get out, some of the men started growling and grumbling. "Ooh," growled, they said, Oh, the Lord's let us down. I thought you said he was going to help us. Woo, 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 woo. I said, you are ungrateful. I said, here in the mercy of God, he's raised up a wonderful miracle of these two empty motor cars. And now we're at least 50 miles from the nearest Japanese. As I thought. As you'll see in a minute, we went. However, that was the beginning. We got out, and there I found the bulk of the Chinese army. And I was brought to the Chinese general, who spoke a little English, and he told me what desperate states we were in. He said all the British had left Burma. We had no hope of getting to India. He said, your only hope is to join the Chinese army, and we are being defeated, but we're fighting our way back into China, into Yunnan. But what were we to do there? The whole coastline was captured by Japanese. None of us spoke Chinese, and I'm sorry to say, none of us trusted most of the Chinese soldiers. And so when I told the men this, they said they didn't agree. They said they would trust me, because I had had former plans in my mind. And they said, I said, well, if you take me at my plans, I'm afraid it's going to be very difficult. They said, what is it? Well, I said, it's going to be a very long walk. They said, how long? Well, I said, I can't tell you exactly, as I've no map, but I should estimate that we'll have a walk of about 600 or 700 miles. And they said, oh, 600! How can we do that? We've no food, we've no drink, we've no anything. My idea was that we'd work our way up to my old missionary area, get up to the hills, where I hoped the Japanese would never come. Actually, they did come. And that then after the monsoons, because I felt we couldn't move through the monsoons, that we'd get villagers to pass us one after another and we'd come out, if possible, in northern Assam. As you'll see, that didn't happen. However, finding that this was the position, I said to the general, now, there is no road here, but I said there is a railway that runs up for about 200 or 300 miles further north. Are the trains running? He said, I'm very sorry to tell you, but there are no trains. 2 days ago, I gave the command that the last train was to go up the railway line and all the bridges were to be blown up. He said, if you'd asked me 2 days ago, I could have helped you, but you're 2 days too late. I'm sorry about it. So the men started growling and grumbling again. However, I said, there's no hope for us. The only way we can walk, instead of getting lost in the jungle, is to keep to the track. So we'll walk along the side of the railway line, even if there's no trains there. We started walking on, and we'd walked a few miles, and it was getting towards evening. And as we came to a bend, somebody said, stop, what's that? And we could hear distinctly, choo, 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 choo. Somebody said, a train. And we raced up round the corner, and there was the train. Now again, this was second wonderful miracle I can't explain at all. I've read the various books, and they all tell the dates which that train left, which was 2 days earlier. It must have only gone about 10 or so miles, and then stopped, apparently waiting for us. I'm sure God had provided it. We had got on, finally. Of course, they were all just open trucks, and some of the Chinese didn't want us to get on, but we got on, and when the darkness came, we put branches over our heads, and the train moved forward in the dark. Once more, I was thrilled, and I kept telling the men, now we're going about 300 miles north by railway, and then we'll be in my old missionary area, and we'll work over, and we are fairly safe. But it was not to be. We only had gone about another 60 or so miles, 50 or 60 miles, when we came just south of Wun Tho, one of my mission stations, and the train stopped in the middle of the night. Wondering what it was all about, I got out and walked to the front of the train, only to discover that a small bridge, culvert, had been bombed, and the train couldn't possibly cross over it. And there we were. We could go no further. My men started growling and grumbling once more. I said, you are ungrateful. Here in the mercy of God, he's raised up two wonderful deliverances. First of all, the two motor cars that were empty, that took us 50 or 60 miles, and now this train, which has taken us about 50 or 60 miles. I said, we're now about 120 miles from the nearest Japanese. As I thought. As you will see, we were not. Well, we were very discouraged. We crossed over the culvert, got into the small station, and we were getting some food from the Chinese, but I was feeling very discouraged indeed, as my hopes had been raised so high that we were going all this way by train. While I was sitting there, one of my men came running up, wildly excited, and said, "Padre, Padre, we've got a car." I said, "My dear fellows, a car is no use." I said, "You're now in the area where I know is a missionary, and there are no roads for a car to go on here. There might be a possible car in this small village, but," I said, "there's nothing going forth. There's a big river north of it, and there's no road to go over it or bridge." So I said, "It's no use." He said, "Please come and see." Well, in desperation I went. And do you know, I found it was the one and only thing that could have saved us at that moment. It was a motor car, but it was not an ordinary motor car. If it had been an ordinary motor car, it would have been of no use to us. It did not have wheels like an ordinary motor car. It had got fitted to run on the railway lines. I must say, I thought I was dreaming. I'd never heard of such a thing before, and it seemed all so absurd. Actually, since then, I have seen one or two and heard of them. But this was a motor car geared to run on the railway lines, not on the road. Well, we got hold of it. The only thing was it would only hold about 6 or 7 people, even if we sat on the roof. What were we to do?